Welcome back to Radio Times. In his best-selling 2005 book, A Whole New Mind, Daniel Pink said that right-brain people, the ones who are creative and empathic, had the right skills needed to succeed. He's got a new book that builds on that theme called Drive. It's based on scientific research and some of the experiences and experiments of forward-thinking companies. Pink writes that the days of carrots and sticks, those extrinsic rewards and punishments are fast disappearing and good riddance. In their place, he says, are intrinsic motivators, things like autonomy, mastery, and purpose. His other books include Free Agent Nation and The Adventures of Johnny Bunko. It's been about 5 or 6 years. And Daniel Pink, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It is great to be back here, Marty.
Thank you very much. So what's wrong with carrots and sticks?
Well, let's talk about what's right with carrots and sticks. Here's the thing. Carrots and sticks, let's take something like money. Money works. Money is a very potent motivator. If you said to me, hey, Dan, I'll give you $100 for jumping over this table, I'm going to go get a running start and jump over the table. Okay? That motivated me. At work, money is a very important motivator. If people aren't getting paid enough, they're being treated unfairly, you're not going to have any motivation. However, the problem with these carrot and stick motivators, what you might think of as if-then motivators, if you do this, then you do that, they work very well in the short term, and they work very well for simple tasks. But for more complex tasks, things that require creativity, they don't work very well. And they also bring with them a whole array of collateral consequences. They narrow our focus. They make us myopic and sacrificing the short term. They can often crush creativity, take the joy out of things. And so this kind of all-purpose motivator that we have in business has the 40 years of science shows some pretty significant downsides, and even better, there's a better way to do it.
Well, you even say that this more sort of carrot and stick approach can also lead to unethical behavior.
Hello, yeah, of course it can.
Are we looking at the last couple of years, the implosion on Wall Street as an example of that?
Sure. Listen, if you give somebody a short-term goal with a high-stakes reward, that's going to get people's attention, and a lot of people are going to race there, and some people are going to take the low road there. Inevitably. And so high-stakes rewards and short-term payoffs inevitably lead to some kind of cheating. Now, the interesting thing, if you're doing something for intrinsic reasons, for the joy of the own reward, it's sort of metaphysically impossible to cheat. I mean,
because you're cheating yourself,
I
right?
I guess, yeah. But I mean, so that's one of the downsides of these if-then motivators, is that they can foster unethical behavior. Not always, but sometimes.
Well, let's talk about some of this research, which leads to this notion that there are things inside of ourselves that drive us to do a good job. Autonomy, you say, mastery, and purpose. Autonomy meaning what?
The urge to direct our own lives, not to be controlled, and not necessarily to be wildly independent of anybody else, but to be in charge of our lives, to have control over our time, over what we do, over how we do it. I think that is and some of the scholars I write about, particularly Edward Deci at Rochester, Richard Ryan at Rochester, have made a very compelling argument that autonomy is human nature, that we are essentially wired to be autonomous and self-directed.
And mastery, I guess the idea that one wants to get better at what one does, right? What a revelation.
Right. It's a fundamental human urge. And the thing is, what's interesting is there are all kinds of examples where when that is denied people, they'll do things that seem irrational, counterintuitive, anti-economic. They'll work for free. They'll make contributions to Wikipedia. There's some interesting research out in this month's Harvard Business Review that says the top motivator for workers, this is a long-term study by a professor at Harvard, the top motivator for workers is making progress.
Hmm.
It's not incentives. It's making progress because we yearn to get better at stuff.
And another thing that you write about, and again, going back to some of this research, is that purpose, or I guess meaning, is that we want to derive some kind of meaning from the hours that we spend at work.
We want to derive some meaning from the hours we spend alive. And since we spend half of those hours alive at work, that's not an exception. And people perform better when they're plugged into some kind of purpose. It doesn't necessarily have to be ending world hunger. It could be providing a really cool, great product to people or providing great service to a customer or something. But if there's not a kind of an animating purpose, then inevitably, it makes perfect sense if you think about yourself. You feel adrift. You feel somewhat demotivated.
I mean, but the idea is that, and I'm thinking about a workplace because mm-hmm. we spend so much time at work and there's so much effort to try to make us all better workers. But the idea of some kind of grand goal for a place or departmental goals, the idea that people are all working for the same thing.
Yeah, it's sometimes there's a really interesting paper that I write about on goals called Goals Gone Wild that says that goals, which we think of as inherently inherently good, goal setting, well, sometimes it's not so good. They basically say that it should be prescription medicine, not over-the-counter medicine that you can take for everything. Because if you have a short-term goal with a high payoff, some people will cheat. And you see this over and over again. You see it in schools where teachers who are being paid to get good scores on standardized tests magically deliver test papers with some erasures. You see it on Wall Street. You see it in salespeople, most of whom do a great job, but if there's a ceiling on their compensation, say for this month, they'll stop doing anything and move all the orders to the next month. And so, you know, we do. The thing about this is that we do. You know, human beings have a lot of drive. We have multiple drives. We have a biological drive. We have this reward and punishment drive. We respond to rewards and punishments. The problem is that we don't always respond in a way that is wealth-enhancing, satisfaction-enhancing. And there's this third drive, the drive to do things because they're interesting, the drive to do things because they matter, the drive to do things because you make a contribution, that the science shows is very powerful and is often the route to high performance, especially in complicated, creative, challenging things.
But, you know, this notion about autonomy, mastery, and purpose, I also think it's something that you see when you see a four-year-old at play. I mean, this is what children are doing when they're trying to figure out the world. They're trying to learn how to tie their shoe. They're trying to figure out how to make the blocks stay on top of each other. I mean, this is how children play slash work, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would like to take what you just said and, you know, broadcast it all over the planet.
We are broadcasting.
It's on a satellite, so it is being broadcast all over the planet. Thank you, Marty, for helping America. Yes, that's exactly. In business, sometimes we have this notion of human beings. They're not going to do anything unless you threaten them with a punishment or entice them with a crunchy carrot. Otherwise, they're just lumps, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't do a thing. Now, what's interesting about that is that no one ever believes that about him or herself. They believe it about other people. And I think that our natural state, human nature, is to be active and engaged. And the reason I say that is precisely because of what you said. I have never seen a four-year-old who's not active and engaged. And if we become passive and inert, I don't know exactly why, but something happens to sort of flip the switch to take us out of that natural state. And in many ways, it's kind of the regimes that we're in that I think crimp autonomy and limit mastery.
Well, and I wonder whether it's our school system with some exceptions. But I also think that a lot of workplaces, I mean, this would probably be a revelation to a lot of bosses, that you can actually give people some freedom. And then if you do that, they actually will produce something. The bosses have to give up some kind of control. Even trust their employees.
You hit on the two most important words, which is control and which is trust. And obviously, they're incompatible. If you're trying to control something, inherently you don't trust them. And what I think is interesting about this is that this is not, you know, when you look at this 40 years of research that I've gone into and done by some really great scientists all over the world, it's that if you listen to what they're saying, it isn't kind of a prescription for, oh, let's all be nicer to each other. Let's all link arms and sing kumbaya. This is a better strategy. This is a small, it's not, I think it's a kinder thing to do. I think it's a more humane thing to do. It's also a more effective thing to do.
You describe a company, and I have to say my jaw dropped when I read it. This company gives their employees, and this was an experiment over time, so they had to work this out. But during the week, the employees have about 20% of their work week that is spent basically them trying to figure out some problem for themselves. Or this is their time at work as opposed to meeting some kind of top-down.
There aren't that many companies that do it, and some companies graduate their way there. For instance, I'll tell you about that in a moment, but there's another company that I write about called Atlassian, a software company. And what they do is they started out doing something far more modest. They said to their employees, software developers, it's Thursday. For the next 24 hours, work on whatever you want. do whatever you want, however you want to do it, with whomever you want to do it. Just show us what you've done at the end of 24 hours. So they call these things FedEx days because you have to deliver something overnight. Little bit of Australian humor, I guess. These 1 day of intense autonomy has produced software fixes, ideas for new products, upgrades for existing products that had never emerged before because of that 1 day of autonomy. And it works so well, as you suggest, they moved to 20% time, where people can spend 20% of their time working on whatever they want. This was actually pioneered by 3M several decades ago, in fact. They had a really incredibly interesting CEO in the 1950s who was completely zigging when everyone else was zagging. And senior scientists there had 15% time. And actually, the Post-it note, 3M's iconic product, the thing we can't live without, was not an official project. It was a 15% project. Huh. Now, Google is sort of the poster company for this. And at Google, something like Google News, which probably a lot of your listeners have been to today, that was not an official project. That was a 20% project. Hmm. My guess is that many of your listeners have a Gmail account. Gmail, not an official project. It was a 20% project. And so that's why that, you know, so autonomy isn't a deviation from people being innovative. In many ways, it's a pathway to it.
Did these employees and these companies, though, have to sort of learn how to use that time? I mean, one can imagine some people just jumping right out of the gate and figuring something out. But I think for others, and I probably would include myself, is sort of wandering around trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to use this extra time?
I think that's exactly right. And that's why you don't see many companies going straight from traditional ways of doing things to 20% time. And a lot of people, if you've been in an environment for 20 years or 30 years where it's basically this kind of mechanistic system of rewards and punishments and you're used to your work being controlled, I don't think you can go to 20%. You do that on Monday and go to 20% time on Tuesday. Right. And so what people need, and actually Richard Ryan, one of the scholars in here, talks about it as scaffolding. Some people need certain scaffolding to get there. So maybe it's let's do it for one afternoon a week, or let's do a FedEx day, or sort of smaller steps to get to that.
We're almost up in a break here, but do you think this can be applied across the board to all companies, all lines of work?
There are some great examples of that at jobs that we don't think of as particularly desirable jobs.
Such as?
Oh, let's take call centers. Call center, terrible job. You're usually monitored. Your calls are timed. You're following a script. Very low autonomy. There's a company called Zappos, a shoe company, that says, we're going to do call centers totally differently. Hmm. We say to their call center employees, no scripts, no monitoring, no timing. You solve the customer's problem. If it takes an hour, that's fine. If it takes a minute, that's fine too. Do it your way. Do it well. What happens? Zappos comes out of nowhere to be one of the top-ranked customer service firms in America.
And employee satisfaction also?
Absolutely. Of course, yeah.
Let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Also want to open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Daniel Pink is our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about some of the ideas in his new book called Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. Stay with us. Call us. We want to know what you think. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Westtown School. Education should make you think about four essential things: who I am, how I see the world, how I want to live, and what I can give back. Since 1799, Westtown has been educating students to help achieve these essentials. Westtown, a Quaker school, is located on 600 acres near Westchester. Their pre-K through 12th grade open house is Saturday, January 9th at 10 a.m. Details at westtown.edu.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. It's 11:20. Uganda is considering putting gay people in prison for life. Ahead at noon on Here and Now, a look at whether Christians from the United States contributed to anti-gay sentiments there. This afternoon's forecast, increasingly cloudy skies, high 37 degrees, and then the chance of snow showers overnight, perhaps into tomorrow morning. Total possible accumulation around 1 inch. Tonight's low, 29 degrees. This is WHYY.
I'm Jonathan Goldstein, and this week on Wiretap, Howard goes to survival camp. Plus, Josh's life is slowly consumed by his obsession with Twitter.
Your mom's a follower of mine, man.
She is not. My mother is not on Twitter.
Dude, she Twitters, man. She gave a real-time breakdown about how to cook a brisket. I thought it was awesome.
That's this week's Wiretap from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. What would make your job better? What motivates you? That's what we're talking about today on Radio Times with our guest Daniel Pink. He's written several books, including A Whole New Mind, The Adventures of Johnny Bunko, A Free Agent Nation, and his new book, Drive, the Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. He looks at some of the interesting science, and it's not brand new science, but science over the last 50 years or so that looks at human motivation, finding that there are intrinsic motivators, and we don't have to just rely on those carrots and sticks. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. It is interesting that your book has come out at a time of intense economic anxiety. I think for many people, they're just happy to have a job.
Absolutely.
They don't care about, they just want to keep those paycheck coming and hopefully those benefits as well. But you're asking us to think beyond that. But I think people are so hunkered down now, just trying to make it from one week to the next and hope that they don't get that pink slip in the mail.
I think that's a very, very good point. This is one reason, but not the only reason, why you have job satisfaction numbers, which came out this week, plummeting. I mean, they're lowest in 20 years, because what it is, it's a double whammy. There's insecurity and there's a lack of autonomy and satisfaction. And so that makes for a very dreary workplace. And what it does, and we've seen this movie before, what it does is it fosters incredible kind of resentment, lack of engagement, and organizations pay a huge price for that, even today. But when things start pricking up, you have this exodus of people out of there.
But are you saying that the companies and even employers in these economic hard times can think beyond the sort of bottom line and just getting the work done, that is possible to...
I think they need to get the work done. I don't think, you know, in a time, obviously they have to get the work done. But in a time like this, if you're managing people, you don't have actually, I mean, there might be a silver lining in all of this. You don't have a whole arsenal of carrots to hand out. You're out of carrots. You got to start maybe treating people like human beings. And so in many ways, these tough times when these extrinsic rewards aren't plentiful, managers, leaders of organizations have to be more creative and have to actually think about some of these things and recognize that you can infuse a sense of satisfaction and purpose and autonomy in any kind of job.
You write about lawyers in this book, but I was also thinking about physicians, and I think many physicians feel like they have almost no control over their time. Doctors make a pretty good living in this country. Some of them make an excellent living in this country. But nonetheless, you hear more and more about job dissatisfaction for people in the medical profession, people leaving, you know, opening restaurants or doing something completely different because they can't stand it anymore.
And why can't they stand it? Part of it is autonomy. They're making medical decisions with an eye toward what an insurance company is going to say. So their ability to make good decisions is constricted. The sense of purpose is, I think, waiting, because the system is so complicated and so much not about healing people and getting people better, but about figuring out the financing of it. And so the combination of, you know, limited purpose and reduced autonomy is difficult. But you look at somebody like a surgeon. In many ways, they're the at the moments they're doing surgery, those are if you interview them and talk to them, those are the moments when they are in flow, when the challenge is so matched to the task that time is melting away, that their sense of self is melting away. Those are really those optimal moments. That flow, that really optimal experience is the pathway to mastery. And what's interesting, though, and what we tend to forget, I write a little bit about a fellow named Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who wrote the book Flow. And what he has found, and it seems to be routinely ignored, is that people are more likely to experience flow at work than in leisure. Because at its best, work is challenging. It's interesting. It's using your talents. Sometimes, once in a while, it matters what you do. Whereas sitting around watching television, maybe not. We tend to think of, and I think one of the things that's happening in a lot of jobs as we move more toward these more creative jobs, is that we tend to think that in some ways, you know, jobs are what, work is what economists would call a disutility. It's not anything good. The only way anybody's going to do it is if they get paid. And so you have to offer a reward on top of it, or else no one would ever do it. But many of the things that we do are in some ways inherently satisfying. And in some cases, and I think this is so fascinating, that people are so dissatisfied at their regular job that they do other things, work-like things, for free. Let's take open source. Open source is his method for creating software where people around the world collaborate across national borders to create software like Linux or Apache, and they do it for free, and they give away the product. Now, when I took economics back in the early 1980s, that was basically like saying that if I took this coffee cup and dropped it, it would float into the air. It would seem to defy the laws of behavioral physics. And yet, open source is creating incredible software that these big companies are actually buying and using or acquiring and using. And you think about that from the experience of the employer. Here you have an open source, very technically sophisticated people doing very technically sophisticated work. They have jobs. And yet, there's something about that job that doesn't scratch the itch for mastery. And so, what do? In their spare time, their discretionary time, they do equally, if not more, technically sophisticated work for free for someone else. So if you look at it from the employer's perspective, you wonder, like, why aren't they not begging them to deploy that talent and brain power and energy for the employer?
But you used an interesting word, ignored, and reading your book, one feels that the research is over here, and it's not like a year old. This is research that goes back for decades.
Exactly.
Then you've got the rest of us over here, that there is this either disconnect or there's some reason why we haven't lined up the research and the actual sort of practical application.
I start out with this book with a study from the 1940s.
Then Harlow, right?
Right. Then a study, which he ended up ignoring, where he basically discovered, hey, wait a second, monkeys do things for intrinsic rewards. Oh, wait a second, I don't like the sound of that. That goes against everything that's going on today. So, push that aside. And this fellow, Edward Deci, who's a hero in this book, a similar kind of finding where he found that layering a contingent reward on top of a inherently interesting activity actually made people less interested in the activity. That got him in the early 1970s fired from a business school.
Hmm.
Now, I think there is this disconnect, and I think the reasons for it are multiple. Number one is that the carrot and stick approach, that method mechanistic approach, it works. It works for simple tasks. It works for short-term tasks. A lot of work certainly in the 20th century, was relatively simple routine work, turning the same screw the same way over and over, or even white-collar work, adding a set of columns over and over, routine, simple, rule-based work. Carrot and stick motivators work pretty well
mm-hmm.
for those.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, which we get totally faked out, is it almost always works in the short term.
So you get results.
You get results. Right. This is the jumping over the table thing. This is how we've always done it. And the other thing I think we tend to neglect is that it's easy. It's really easy. It's easy to design. It's easy to implement. It's easy to measure. And this other stuff, autonomy and mastery, it's much more difficult.
Hmm.
You actually have to work to get it right.
I don't know if it's a generational thing, or maybe even the kinds, as you had mentioned, computer development company or a software development mm-hmm. company. But I'm thinking my son works in New York at a production company. And what I observe is that there's no line between working and playing. It's not unusual for them to be at work at 12 midnight. They might roll in at 12 the next day, and that there's this interesting sort of crossover. There isn't work over here and play over there at all, and there's a pool table and all this kind of stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
I think that's part of it. I think it goes back in some ways to your example of the four-year-old. Four-year-olds don't make this finely grained distinction between what's work and what's play. I think we make a distinction between what's challenging and fulfilling and interesting and what's deadening. I think not everybody, but a lot of physicians today are much more interesting. But even what's interesting is that even jobs that we wouldn't covet, it's possible to infuse that mm-hmm. with some of these things. So there's a great example study of hospital janitors. Most of us wouldn't covet the job of a hospital janitor. And yet the study showed that there were some hospital janitors who showed up, swept the floor, left. But there are other ones in different environments who were given the opportunity, as these researchers say, to sculpt their jobs just a little. And so they were encouraged, hey, if you want, when you sweep a floor, talk to the patient, see how the patient's doing. They encourage nurses, hey, if you need something, you can ask the hospital janitors to help you out and explain why you're doing it. Lo and behold, that small amount of autonomy to sculpt an otherwise fairly uninteresting job. Job satisfaction goes up, turnover goes down. Those hospital janitors end up moving through the ranks. So it's basically, it's pretty simple. 50 years of science says, hey, it's a little more effective to treat people like human beings than like horses.
Wow.
A staggering scientific revelation.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers into the conversation. I think they have a feel for some of what you write about in your new book. And again, our guest is Daniel Pink. The book is called Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. And a surprise, surprise, people like to be treated like human beings and not horses. You heard it on Radio Times. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we'd love to hear from people who are the workers and people who are in administration and just get a sense about how some of these ideas are playing out in your life. Let me get to Ira from Doylestown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Ira. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to point out kind of a potential dark side to this approach. I was once senior management in a customer service company that had the employee comes first type of an orientation. The idea being that if the employees are happy, they'll be more customer service oriented, solve problems, better service, and less interested in extrinsic type of reward.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that was one of the things that attracted me to the company. What I found out over time was that this was a very cynical, manipulative approach towards the employees, that the sincerity wasn't quite there. And once the employees caught wind of this, it was actually counterproductive because it was clear that this was a management technique to make people more loyal to the company, to work harder, longer hours for less pay, and to be happier about it.
Well, you know, Ira, that's a great point, and let me give our guest, Daniel Pink, a chance to respond to that. And
I think Ira is absolutely right. I mean, what that is basically that's an extrinsic reward and intrinsic rewards clothing. I mean, it's not legitimate. It's not authentic. And people can spot that a mile away.
Sure.
And what that does is that kind of thing where you sort of give a false level of autonomy, or you're saying, oh, we can use these things as manipulative levers to control people's behavior. That is so profoundly demotivating. It's as demotivating, if not more demotivating, as not paying people enough. And so if you're not going to do this legitimately, you might as well not do it.
But as you say, and you list a couple of companies in here who are doing some of these things that play on some of these ideas about motivation, intrinsic motivation, that these are real programs with real results. They're not faking it. Just picking up on what Ira was saying.
No, they're not faking it. If they are faking it, I can almost guarantee it's not going to work. And what you have is you have the results that you're getting from a place like Atlassian, or results like you're getting from some of these what are called results-only work environments, where people don't have a schedule.
Right.
They show up when they want. They just have to get their work done, do whatever they want. Not do whatever they want. They have autonomy over their time. So they show up when they want, or show up not at all. They just have to get their stuff done. Started by two HR consultants in this very subversive way in the corporate offices of Best Buy. And now you have some big companies doing it, but a huge number of what I write about is, a company no one in Charlottesville, Virginia, that no one ever heard of, that went from a kind of you're here at 9 and you leave at 5 to, hey, get your stuff done, do it however get it done. And what happens is, as you suggested earlier, Marty, some people can't handle that,
right.
And so they lost a few people, but the vast majority of people ended up liking it. And this fellow Jeff Gunther, who runs this company, young guy, 30 years old or so, he said, my dad's generation thought of people as resources, okay? Basically as passive things that you extract and tap and control. And he said that's a backward-looking approach. You have to look at people who are working with you as partners, who aren't any different from you, who have the same set of motivations. And if you treat people like you want to be treated, I mean, again, I don't mean to sound so saccharine about it, but what we have is that our gut instincts about these things, our gut instincts that human beings have desires other than simply chasing the carrot or avoiding the stick, which we believe about ourselves, which we believe about our spouse or our partner, which we believe about our kids, applies pretty universally. And if we understand that, we can live better and work smarter.
Ira, thanks for the call. Let me get Jeff from Wynwood to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah, Marty. Great show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to, I'm a college teacher, and I teach English, and I'm always struggling with motivation in students. And I was wondering if your guest could maybe give some sort of general things that I could think about to, you know, to achieve that sort of motivation.
Well, and Jeff, let me just ask you a few questions. Are you saying that students aren't doing the work, or they don't seem interested in the work? And I'm curious what you teach on top of that.
I teach English, college English,
okay.
And they, you know, and they, and yeah, I mean, to get them to see the purpose of the work, I try, you know, that this supposedly, you know, oh, I don't need that because I'm going to go and be an engineer or something like that. You know, or they, you know, and again, getting to turn things in on time, or just to get them to do things and to see that, you know, that it's important.
And that it's has its own rewards.
Right,
on top of
yeah.
that. Right.
Well, exactly.
Daniel Pinko.
Well, Jeff, can I ask Jeff a question?
Yes,
so,
of
Jeff,
course.
Are folks not turning things, are your students not turning things in on time? Are they not doing the work? Or are they
doing it in kind of a list compliant way? Well, this is blasphemy because I sort of give them that sort of autonomy in the sense that I say, well, this is a date. You know, if you're one of those people that needs to turn things in on time, here's a date. I have a million papers to read, so if you turn it in a week later, 2 weeks later, I'm fine with that, whatever.
And so what happens, Jeff?
Well, I mean, sometimes I get punished because they'll say they want me to be their dad, but I'm not their dad. But
right.
That's one thing. But the other thing is just getting them to I'm just trying to motivate them to see that this stuff does matter, to get them interested,
One of the things that you see in education is, and it's funny, I asked this question to a lot of the scientists who are doing this research, who also are college professors like Jeff, and I said, what about grades?
Right.
And almost every one of them said, oh, and how do you reckon with it? They have to do it. The system requires them to do it. And so what they do is they, for instance, some of these folks will give students the choice. I need to evaluate you, and I need to give you a grade. How do you want to be evaluated? Do you want to be evaluated with a test? Do you want to be evaluated with a project? Do you want to be evaluated with a paper?
Mm-hmm.
Modest things for engagement. I actually think that relating the purpose of what this is, what the exercise is really important. And not only in a purely instrumental way, but the idea that an engineer doesn't know how to write or express him or herself is ludicrous. And so I think sort of fostering that is valuable too.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what we have is you have to think about these students. They're coming from, you know, 12 years of carrot and stick, external motivators, do things for instrumental reasons. And in some ways, I see when they graduate, they're sort of adrift because they don't know what to do. What we have is an education system too often built for compliance and not built for engagement.
Or experience, maybe even too, on top of that.
Well, experience is a form of engagement. I mean, it's you're doing something. You're in it, and so the education system we have is great for getting people to comply. But compliance has its limits. And so what you have now is you have students who are compliant, and then compliance, I think, leads to a certain listlessness.
Well, Jeff, we didn't solve your problem, but you raise an important one, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. We're talking with Daniel Pink today on Radio Times about his new book called Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Lung cancer is one of the most prevalent cancers in the U.S. and accounts for the most cancer deaths. The thoracic oncology program at Fox Chase, led by noted expert Dr. George Simon, offers molecularly tailored personalized treatments and access to clinical trials. Fox Chase also specializes in minimally invasive lung cancer surgery. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase, perfecting the science of compassionate cancer care.
It's 11:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. This afternoon at 2 on Talk of the Nation, a look at unraveling the state of the CIA in Afghanistan. This afternoon's forecast, increasingly cloudy skies, breezy, high 37 degrees. And then the chance of snow showers overnight, perhaps into tomorrow morning. Total possible accumulation, around 1 inch. Tonight's low, 29 degrees. And then temperatures holding nearly steady on Friday in the low to mid-30s.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's Daytime News Magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up. plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Daniel Pink about his new book called Drive. We're talking about, and he's saying actually in this book, that those days of carrots and sticks, the extrinsic, is that right? Extrinsic rewards and punishments are disappearing. I don't know why that doesn't sound right coming out. And have their limitations, and he says intrinsic motivators, things like autonomy, mastery, and purpose, are really the motivators that can drive us to do work or to perform in school or even can be applied to family life. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm imagining, though, a place that wants to incorporate some of these ideas, or maybe even a department. But there are people at work that will just never sign on to this. I mean, there's just no question they're not going to do that. And maybe even rebel, or it just doesn't suit their style. What do you do about these people?
I think you try everything you can to convince them, and I think that you end up doing. I mean, the way that organizations change, the way that anything changes, is not someone at the top saying we're going to change. Every political systems, organizations change in actually subversive ways. You have people who are doing things out of the ordinary, people who are conveying ideas and having conversations that run afoul of the orthodoxies, who are changing these things. So, for instance, you have people now. Let's take performance reviews. It's a great example.
Or as we say, the dreaded performance review, right?
Exactly, the DPR. No one likes performance reviews, not the giver, not the givee. And we've sort of forgot the first principles, which is that performance reviews are about achieving mastery. It's about how do you get better at something. Well, no one's going to get better at anything by having a performance review twice a year. Even worse, obviously, anybody who's been through them, it's not an open conversation. It's kabuki theater, where everyone is kind of playing the rehearsed roles. It's horrible. So what you have now is some folks doing do-it-yourself performance reviews, saying it's an idea that I explore in this book, where you set out your goals at the beginning of the month, and you say, here are my goals, learning goals, performance goals. At the end of the month, you call yourself into the office and assess how you're doing. How are you faring? Where is it working? Where is it not? What tools do you need? Now, what's interesting about this is that, and this goes to the point about how organizations change, in this self-organized way, you have people who are doing this with peer groups who are saying, listen, I want to navigate my career. I want to do something that matters. So let's assemble three or four people, and once a month we'll go out to a coffee place and we'll talk about our goals and we'll talk about how we're doing and we'll give each other feedback and we'll help and hold each other accountable. Now, that's not within the confines of an organization. It's actually in some ways, a subversive act, and that's how these things change. The other thing that happens is that you have, that company Atlassian doing the FedEx days we talked about earlier in the program. Those are entrepreneurs. Those are not people at established companies. These are folks who are founders who are doing things their own way. And you see that with an institution that's been around for 100 years is far less likely to change than someone who often has departed that institution and says, I can do this better. I can do it a better way. I can do better things. And that's where a lot of this innovation is coming from. And inevitably, in a free market, the stodgy, stale institutions begin to founder and the young upstarts begin to define what are the best practices.
But I can also imagine at a company that's trying to institute some of these changes, they're just people that are not going to be either be able to do it or want to do it or are willing to sign on to this.
I think
this.
That everybody in some ways is able to do it. I think you're absolutely right that you have a lot of managers who don't want to do this, who will actively resist this, because what it does is it says, wait a second, my job is to control people. You're saying that I don't control people? You know, it's an existential crisis of sorts. Like, why am I here? And that's kind of what I'm asking. Why are you here?
Let me get David from Elkins Park to join our conversation. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Yes. The last caller mentioned, who was also an academic, I am, raise some issues. I want to take it from the side, not of the student, but from the professors. It was wonderful being, and it still is, in the world of universities and colleges, because we can pursue things very independently.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a recent trend, and I just want comments on this, intellectual property rights. To me, after a lot of thought, rather dirty words. And here's why, because I have done my work, my research work, my ideas, because I love to produce good ideas. And now we're being told suddenly that if you don't lay property claims to ideas, we won't get good ideas. And I'm quite insulted. So you have an interesting thing going on where we're told now within the world of the universities that we have to more or less have these monetary incentives if we're going to do good things. And I've done it for years without that.
Well, that's fascinating, David. Let me get Daniel
please.
Are
any comments, and I'll take my call off the air now.
I think that David, in some ways, is asking his own question. Here you have somebody basically saying that, implying at least, that this demotivates me. That when you layer in these external rewards, make me do something for these kind of external rewards, then it becomes uninteresting. On intellectual property rights, one of the most interesting, fascinating, counterintuitive things going on is this idea of the Creative Commons and people sharing and people making contributions that doesn't have this kind of purely rational economic self-interest to it. I mean, again, what's so interesting about some of this is that it goes against, you know, when I learned economics, I said people are rational calculators of their economic self-interest. That's how we are. We're economic robots. Mm-hmm. And that's not who we are. And the whole field, the burgeoning field of behavioral economics has shine a light on that, winning people like Daniel Kahneman, who's not even an economist, a Nobel Prize in economics. And what you have now is you have behavior that is seemingly anti-economic, sharing with people, giving stuff away. Why are people doing that? And there's been a lot of research, particularly on open source, and the two big motivators on open source are challenges, doing something challenging, and also making a contribution.
Right. But here's David, who's saying that he sees in his own university or college, and perhaps even across the country, that what's happening is in direct opposition to what you're talking about.
But it's also in direct opposition to some of the most potent cultural trends in the world of technology and the world of organizations, which is this move toward flattening of organizations and the move toward Creative Commons and giving away things. So in some ways, you have a university at an inflection point trying to understand what to do, and they're taking a turn backward.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine. I mean, it might be valuable. It might be useful in the short term, but in the long run, it's that this is how institutions become irrelevant.
David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Mike from Bayer, Delaware has to say. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Yeah, I want to give an example of my work experience. When I was a manager at a bank, I was often asked to go into new departments and improve performance. And I always started out by walking in, introducing myself, and asking the employee doing the job, how can you do your job better?
Hmm.
One time a guy, Marco, said, well, I can run two machines. And I said, well, how come you're not?
Hmm.
And he said, well, they're afraid that I'm going to put out bad work. And just then the guy running the other machine went on break. And I said, well, let's do it, Marcos. You know, start running two machines. And by the end of the day, the guy had done more work than anybody had ever done on that machine. And the point is that they had been doing it the same way for 20 years.
Right.
And the other end of that is that, so I'm the manager that always asked to improve it, but when it comes time to layoffs, I'm always the first guy to go because I have empowered the employees. And what they need now is a manager that's going to follow the marching orders, you know, make sure people come in on time. These are the rules, follow them.
Right.
And I'm kind of like the rule breaker. And it's definitely harder to manage this way where you give people autonomy because once you give them that, they can, the ideas just come out and it's the management part comes in just controlling the amount of ideas and keeping it structured and document the processes that you put in place.
Well, you know, Mike, first of all, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I think a lot of people listening would prefer to have you as their boss than a lot of bosses that are out there.
I think a lot of smart entrepreneurs would like to hire somebody like Mike. I think
who asked a very simple but basic question and look at the results he got.
Yeah,
right?
And you know what? He also listened. Managers think their job is to talk. And what he did is he asked a question and he listened. And what's interesting about that in that tale, here you have this massive burst of productivity. There's not a single external incentive there.
Yeah. But and Mike, I do appreciate your call to Radio Times. But then he says, you know, you empower people and the rules change. And in his case, he feels like, you know, he's out of a job.
Yeah, I can understand that from his perspective. But, you know, what I would do if I were running that organization, that company, is I would say, hey, all right, Mike, go do your magic in this other division. I mean, I would not lose.
But
know.
Why doesn't that happen? I mean, here are the tangible results.
It doesn't happen for a number of reasons. Number one, it's kind of frightening because someone at the even higher than Mike is having that same kind of calculation and has said, wait a second, if I start hiring people like Mike, maybe I don't have to do anything. So they're concerned about that. The other thing is that remember the resist. There was almost it's a wonderful story. There was a moment of opportunity when the other fellow at the machine walked away. And Marco, the fellow in the story, had known about this and wanted to do this, but he was actually – people resisted his doing it. It was only when that guy walked away that they tried this thing. So you have a lot of managers out there, a lot of people out there who fear giving up control, who don't think that other people are trustworthy. However, they themselves – don't want to be controlled and think they are trustworthy. Mm. I mean, it's like this. It's like the old journalist adage, you know, always extrapolate from your own experience. You're not that special.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I wish you the best of luck as well. Let me get Rick from, looks like Napa Valley, to join our conversation. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
Good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Go ahead, Rick.
I wanted to thank you for taking my call, and I wanted to give a call. I work here in Napa Valley, and I have a social media job, and I think that Daniel's really onto something, not only with this book, but the last book, because the emerging social media jobs really require a lot of autonomy and also the ability to have a right brain and tell a story and think creatively. And in a way, when I was getting my job, I was actually reading A Whole New Mind, and I referenced that in my interview when I got this job, because it's really important to be able to think creatively and tell a story. So I wanted to see kind of what Daniel's thoughts were about these new kind of jobs and how it relates to this new book, Drive.
Fair enough. And Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times.
Yeah, well, thanks, Rick, for that nice call. I think that social media is in some ways all about autonomy. Think about all the people who are Twittering. No one's getting paid to send out Twitter messages. They're doing it because no one's getting paid to follow anybody. They're doing it because it's interesting. They're doing it because it's expressive. And now I think that can eventually cascade into economic value. We've seen that already. But the ultimate impetus was this freedom to say something and listen to interesting things. I think if you had set up a Twitter system where every follower you get a dime in your account, or you know, everything that gets retweeted, you get a nickel in your account, I think you'd have a far less interesting, robust kind of ecosystem of conversation going on with Twitter.
Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and a shameless plug for Radio Times. You can follow us on Twitter, as you can many other groups and programs like Radio Times. Let me go back to something pretty prosaic here, but this has to do with compensation. As you said, rewards do work, and people should be paid for what they do. You talk about fairness. You talk about, and we talked about, useful performance measures, something that you mentioned before. But you also say, and there's been some interesting research about paying more than the average.
Yeah, this is kind of another weird counterintuitive thing. There's a fellow who got a Nobel Prize in economics who did some research where let's take a place like Philadelphia. If you're an accountant working at a certain sized firm and you have 4 years of experience and you're in the Philadelphia labor market, we can look at data and say, pretty much predict how much money you're going to make in a pretty narrow band.
Right.
So he looked at that in Silicon Valley for some engineers, and he noticed there were certain firms that were paying outside of the band. They were paying more than what was called the labor market, the market clearing wage. What's going on? This seems crazy. And he investigated, and they found out that these were actually the higher performing firms. What was going on here? What they said is they had good people, and they said, what we're going to do, I mean, maybe not consciously, I think it was an intuitive thing. What they found, and this is in some ways the secret to motivation, is that you pay people enough money to take the issue of money off the table, okay? And if you pay people more than the average, they feel like they're being treated fairly. And you take the issue of money off the table. So they're not thinking about, am I being treated fairly? Am I being compensated adequately? Is Joe down the block getting paid more? They think, oh, I'm going to focus on my work. And so now, obviously, paying people more than average is not something everybody can do statistically. But the broader point is money can be a very great demotivator in some ways, but money as a motivator is best when you pay people enough to take the issue of money off the table so that people can do good work.
Let me squeeze one more caller in. This is Maxine from Erdenheim. Maxine, we're almost out of time on Radio Time, so go ahead.
I'll speak quickly. I recently retired after teaching for many years in the Philadelphia school system, and what I found that was very frustrating, I think most teachers in most systems do, is that everybody's looking to improve education both nationally and at the local level, but they very seldom come in and talk to those of us who teach.
So it's
usually the theoreticians who have the ideas, people who have either taught just a handful of years or not at all, and they're trying to just change everything.
Sure, and this is this disconnect we've been talking about.
Sure, it's legislators who often haven't been in a classroom for 25 years who are sort of doing drive-by legislation, imposing these rules on schools and doing things like saying the way we can get better teachers is if we link teacher pay to standardized test scores, which is ludicrous in a way if you think about it, because no one goes into teaching to make money. Okay, if they do, they're foolish. The other thing is that we know that if you have a high stakes reward, some people will cheat, and you see that already. Teachers don't like performance pay, so-called performance pay, because it can lead to favoritism from building principals. The other thing some people have suggested, well, let's have a whole variety of metrics: principal evaluations, student evaluations, colleague evaluations, continuing education. And then you have this whole elaborate measurement scheme, and so you're spending more time measuring teachers than doing anything. I think the solution goes to your earlier question, which is, let's do this. Let's raise teachers' base salaries and make it easier to get rid of the duds. I think that is the kind of motivational reform that could actually make a difference in schools.
Maxine, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Daniel Pink, thanks for joining
My
us today
pleasure, Marty.
On Radio Times. And his book is called Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. We appreciate your phone calls to Radio Times. You can also leave us an email at whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And you can also hear Radio Times on the Sirius XM channel NPR Now 134 and NPR Talk Sirius 135. Thanks again so much for joining us today on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media.